From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Kate Harding first sold the proposal for a book on rape culture, this was in 2012, the issue was having a moment. A lot of talk online and in the media because of certain high-profile cases. So her editor and her agent told her to get the book finished as quickly as she could, you know, take advantage of the moment. Well, it took longer than she thought, but the issue, of course, didn't fade away. Americans, she says, are still talking seriously about rape and rape culture, which is good, but the ugly stories that are finally driving this conversation continue to happen in the context of a culture that, for some reason, is better at supporting the rapists than the victims. Kate Harding is joining us today to talk about how rape culture plays into American culture. Join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Because we're used to backing into the subject of rape and sexual assault, we're really careful, for example, with words that we use, lots of passive voice and euphemisms. And because of that, Kate Harding's book may seem shocking at times because really she comes right out and she says it. She uses very, very direct language. But if we keep speaking in passive voice, she says in her book, how are we supposed to address rape as a public health and a safety issue? And here's one of those things that Harding says that gets right to the point. Every American boy is at risk of growing up to become a rapist. Now, she knows that sounds kind of outrageous at first, and she does clarify what she does not mean by that. Not every American boy, for example, has a fundamentally rapey nature, she writes. That's not what she means. What she means is that American boys, and her book focuses on America, by the way, even though this is an issue, of course, everywhere in the world, American boys are growing up in a rape-supportive culture, reared in a culture of aggressive masculinity. Kate Harding is joining us today to talk about the rise of rape culture. Her book is called Asking for It. Kate Harding is a feminist writer who has written for the blog Jezebel and Dame magazine, among others. She's co-author of Lessons from the Fatosphere. Her new book, I mentioned, it's called Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. And she's joining us today from a studio in Minneapolis. And Kate Harding, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
Were you able to, let me jump right in term rape culture. Were you able to track down the origin of the term? It's been around a long time, you say.
It has definitely been around since the feminist movement in the 1970s. And Susan Brown Miller wrote a landmark book called Against Our Will, where she discussed, it was just an incredible history of rape as a social phenomenon. And I feel like it grew out of that, but I am not actually sure about who was the first to use the phrase rape culture.
You confess right up front in your book that at first you kind of balked at the term. You worried that it might be overstating things a bit.
Right. It sounds, you know, even to me, where I am a feminist very, you know, steeped in this kind of language and these issues, it really shocked me the first time that I heard it. And I thought, that's ridiculous. You know, as a culture, we abhor rape. We think of it as the second worst crime after murder. But once I started reading and learning what feminists meant by rape culture, the more I understood that they were really giving a name to something that needed a name, which is all of these interlocking systems that work to support the needs of rapists more than victims.
The language I mentioned in the introduction, the language that you use, just your writing style, which this has always been your writing style. You're up front. You're really funny. You're smart.
Thank you.
But you're really intent on using the right words, no euphemisms. I mean, you come right out. How important is that in this scheme of things?
I think it's really important to me that we talk about what's actually happening here, that we're not using that passive voice that you mentioned, that we're not saying that rape is this thing that happens. We are talking about the people who actively do it. We're talking about what it actually means, because the word rape, too, has been so diluted by people using it casually and colloquially, like, you know, the example being like in a video game, somebody being like, oh, dude, you just got so raped.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing really dilutes what we're talking about, which is a very serious violation of another person's bodily autonomy and safety. And so bringing it back to what we're actually talking about really kind of drives home how inadequate our language and our conversations about rape tend to be.
You were raped in 1992.
Yes.
You were 17, mm-hmm. in college.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, the book is really candid and really upfront. But did you at all wonder whether to include your own experience and how to include your own experience in all of this?
I did, only because I was kind of trying to avoid doing a bunch of stories of like, this is my rape, this is what it meant, only because I feel like plenty of writers before me have done that work of interviewing victims and telling their own stories and really trying to explain, like, this is what we're talking about, where very often it was a matter of trying to elucidate what we mean by acquaintance rape or date rape, that these things are rape just as much as the stranger in the alley, and in fact, they're a much more common version of rape. So I felt like a lot of groundwork had been laid there already, and I didn't necessarily want to just reiterate similar stories, and mine is one that is you know, very typical. The freshman who shows up on campus, doesn't know what she's doing, doesn't have any experience drinking, and, you know, starts dancing with a guy, and there it goes. But I also didn't want to act as though I didn't have, you know, a stake in this.
Yeah.
That, you know, I wanted to disclose that I am a survivor, because obviously that's going to be something that I have written about it publicly before.
Sure.
And that would be an angle for people to criticize me as, you know, I'm too invested.
It's interesting, too, the way you talk about the how the elements of your story of being being raped and really help us understand kind of the larger picture of this story. The reluctance to report, for example. I mean, you declined the rape kit that was offered you at the time.
I did, and because at 17 years old, the only thing I could think, sitting there in the hospital emergency room as they were saying, do you want us to bring in police officers and do a rape kit? I said no, because I didn't want my parents to find out.
Right.
And, you know, now in my 40s, that makes me so incredibly sad for that young woman, but and for, you know, any young victims who have felt the same. But that's what was going through my mind, and I think it's a good example of how we expect so much of victims, because it's this, you know, quote unquote, he said, she said thing, mm-hmm. that we want victims to be perfect, to do everything right, to make every decision in the aftermath of this incredible trauma, just the way we would hope that they would in order to, you know, up our chances of getting a conviction later. And if the victim doesn't do all of those things in exactly the right order, then we think, oh, well, maybe she's making it up. Maybe it wasn't such a big trauma.
There's this story you tell about that experience. After it had happened, you were with a friend on campus, I think it was, and you saw this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who raped you. And you said, that's the guy. That's the guy. And she said, no, that's not the guy. That's so-and-so. That's John Smith or whatever. That's not possible, Kate.
Right.
And that seems so telling in the context of it, because you talk about how one of the most pernicious things, it seems, about the way rape culture manifests itself is how it takes the average person, and we are more inclined to somehow identify not with the victim, but with the person who committed the crime. And that seems like that's what's kind of going on here in this part of the story. Would you talk about what's going on here?
Right. Well, I mean, that's part of it for sure, that I think typically as a culture, that is always our first thought. It's, you know, if it's someone that we like or admire, we don't want to believe it about him.
Right.
So then we go to, okay, well, how could this not be true about him? And usually the answer is, well, the victim must be lying. In this case, she said, you're mistaken. because I had not actually, you know, gotten the guy's name the night before. Yeah. And so I just recognized him. And it was this very small campus, I should say. It's not like I was at this huge urban campus and happened to run into him the next day. It was a campus of fewer than 500 students altogether. Right. We all ate in the same dining hall at the same time, that kind of thing. And so when I said to her, that's him, she just automatically said, no, you've got to be wrong. And I just thought, okay, well, you know, I didn't know that. I kind of, you know, felt my blood run cold and I really thought that was him. But obviously, if you know this guy and he's a good guy, then he didn't do that. And then we found out later, or I found out later, sort of through the grapevine from someone who didn't even know that I had identified him as my rapist that day. Someone told me about him raping someone else that had happened in the past. And I went, okay, wait a minute. You know, maybe this woman that I told was wrong and I was right in the first place. But it's amazing how quickly you come to doubt yourself like that as soon as somebody says it. And I do think that it's very hard when we like and admire someone to immediately make that shift as soon as someone says, well, they raped me, to say, oh, my God, you know, now my entire concept of this person has to change or else this person is wrong or lying.
Yeah. Okay, so aside from the idea that your friend sort of knew this guy and he seemed like a good guy, that's mm-hmm. impossible. The bigger question that you get at is, again, that idea that how we somehow – the average person in this country, probably in the world, tends to identify not with the victim but with the person who identified the crime, who committed the crime. Would you explain how it is that work? Why is it that we're relating to
Sure.
the perpetrator rather than the victim in some way?
Well, I think it's an incredibly common human fear is being accused of a crime you didn't commit.
Yeah.
And the helplessness that you feel if that happens, and especially if it's just people are believing one person who could be lying. And so I completely understand where that comes from. But then it kind of becomes a gendered thing where that's men's experience typically, although one in 71 men will be raped in a lifetime, at least those are the American numbers. Men typically hear of a rape and or hear of a rape accusation and think, God, that accusation could happen to me.
Right.
Whereas women are raised to believe the rape could happen to me. And in many cases, we have the experience that says it could and it did. And so I think that's something where we need everyone to be able to empathize a little bit more with victims who may not be exactly like them, where it's women, it's very often gay, bisexual men, transgender people who are at higher risk than, you know, the average guy who's in power, basically, which is a white, straight, cisgender male.
How embedded in our culture is this? And we'll break this down as we go. We'll get to the particulars, but give me sort of a broad sense of that. Just how embedded in American culture and world culture, though you focus on this country, of course.
Extremely
how embedded is
awesome.
It? Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's hugely embedded in the entire world culture, but absolutely American culture, which is what I know and what I focused on in this book. It is in our pop culture. It's in our laws. It's in our politics. It's in the way that we handle cases in the justice system. It's in the way that the news media reports on sexual assaults and rapes. And so it's just absolutely everywhere. And that's what allows people to believe that, you know, as individuals or even as one sort of cog in that machine, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just trying to, you know, present a nuanced portrait. But you get all of those things working together and they're all ultimately sending the same message, which is that we can't trust people who report rape and that, you know, the worst thing that can possibly happen is being falsely accused of rape as opposed to the worst thing that can possibly happen is being raped.
Right. There's this weird paradox, too, that you write about. We seem to have this – we talk a good game. You know, we have this mm-hmm. intolerance for sexual violence in American society. But then we have really low rates of actually convicting offenders.
Yeah.
Now, what does that tell us?
I mean, it tells us a couple of things. Like, the optimistic version is that – because there is generally only one person's testimony as evidence in the typical rape case, because most rapes are, again, committed by people known to the victim, not strangers, and there's not necessarily any extra violence over and above the rape that would leave physical evidence.
Right.
So it is very hard to convict because of that. And that's sort of a good thing. You know, you don't want to send people to prison for crimes that they didn't commit. You don't want to send them there without a lot of rock solid evidence. But we need to find a way to handle these things better, because we are also so extremely suspicious of victims. If you report a rape, you are very likely to be investigated or interrogated almost as though you were a criminal yourself. And in some cases that I write about in the books, there are people who reported genuine rapes. The police officers didn't believe them for one reason or another, and then actually charged them with false reporting. Mm-hmm. So these people who were victims of a violent crime go try and report it to the police, and they end up under investigation and under arrest. So it's very frustrating, and that's one of the reasons that rape is an incredibly underreported crime, because people know the process is likely to be frustrating, humiliating, and nowhere, you know, and with no justice. So it's, you know, it's very possible that the justice system we have is just not equipped to handle this sort of crime, and we need to look at other solutions.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about that as we go along, because you have this mm-hmm. section about false accusations, which seems to be the mm-hmm. sort of existential fear in this culture more than anything
right.
else. but let me ask, I want to define our terms, because sure. this is important to you. Explain what it is that makes rape a crime, which seems like a dumb question. But if we can nail down the crime part, you say in your book, none of the other stuff, like what was she wearing and how much experience did she have with sex and did she fight hard enough, none of that should matter. Let's just
right.
talk about that as a rape as a crime.
Absolutely. And let me say, that's not a dumb question at all, because the way that we react to rape is we act as though it's sort of sex gone bad.
Right.
And so if it's just sex gone bad, then, well, you know, if maybe she was a sexual being who at some point wanted some part of that, then it wasn't that huge of a trauma, you know, unless she was a virgin, unless she was, you know, doing everything she could to make sure that no man came near her, then she must have wanted some part of it, right? Mm. But what rape actually is not sex gone bad, but just a violation of another person's autonomy. It's a violation of another person's ability to make their own decisions about what happens to their own body. And it is a matter of domination, not, you know, it's not that men see a pretty woman and become sexually incontinent and then suddenly they're rapists.
Right.
It's that men who want to rape choose their victims and then dominate them. And so that's the thing. If we recognize that that's what's going on here and that's what makes it a crime, is that you are depriving someone of their liberty, of their ability to make decisions about their own body and what they do with it, then it doesn't matter, you know, any of that sort of ancillary stuff about what she was wearing and where she was and who she was with and what she was drinking. None of that has any bearing on whether her autonomy was violated.
There's this major misconception you go after in the book. This idea that men and women are – our brains are just wired differently. It's that whole men are from Mars, women
right.
are from Venus crap that I guess we bought for a while. And maybe we still believe it. But you say this idea, this way of thinking, that we're just different. The genders are different, kind of contributes to the way we kind of give in to these myths about rape, I guess.
Definitely. It's really a pernicious idea, because it makes us believe that men and women can't understand each other in sexual situations. And so that's where we get into. People are so worried about things like, you know, affirmative consent policies, which I'm sure we'll get to talk about a little bit more, where you're expecting someone to be aware of ongoing enthusiastic consent from a partner. People get really angry about this and say, you know, oh, well, you know, am I going to have to fill out forms in triplicate? Am I going to have to, you know, be checking in and stopping what I'm doing every 30 seconds to make sure that the person is still into it? And what I say is no, because we do understand each other. And when in sexual situations like that, there's a whole lot of nonverbal communication that goes on, and that works just fine. And you can tell if someone is enthusiastic or not. So this idea that some guys just get carried away and don't realize that their partner isn't consenting, that's ridiculous. Like, if you can't tell that someone who has lost all enthusiasm for what you are doing, regardless of whether they're kicking or scratching at you or screaming, you know, you're then you have no business trying to have sex at all.
You know? Well, it's, I mean, so let's talk about how this plays out on in TV and the movies, because you write mm-hmm. about this. And this idea that, I guess it's the sense that somehow sexual encounters in movies are not real. I think mm-hmm. we sort of understand that intuitively in some way. Mm-hmm. But how much of that is playing a role in the cues that we're looking for in real life? Because, you know, consent and the reality of sex is so different from the sort of choreographed stuff you see on a TV show.
Absolutely. You know, people, when I'm talking about this, often people say, oh, well, you know, pornography is setting boys' expectations now. And I say, well, irrespective of that, look at romantic comedies. Look at the way people just start kissing and then they fall into bed and it all happens wordlessly. There's no negotiation. There's no mistakes. And because, you know, it is literally scripted, you know, they know the outcome. They know that, you know, the other person wants everything. But in real life, you need to be constantly checking in with your partner. And again, I don't mean that means you stop and you have a coffee break every 30 seconds.
And sign a form. Yeah.
You know, it means you keep your eyes open, maybe. You know, you look and things happen and things change. You know, I always use the example of, like, in plenty of perfectly good sexual encounters, there will be a moment when it's like, ooh, you know, that's no longer comfortable, or you're on my foot, you know? Mm. And so we make these small negotiations where, you know, someone says, wait, that's no good, stop it, and you move on and you don't remember it by the end of that. And so that's the kind of thing that when we talk about ongoing enthusiastic consent, it's that. It's just being aware of what your partner wants.
There's this, I think the term you use is retroactive consent that goes on in a lot of movies. You mm-hmm. mentioned a few. Anyone who's seen Game of Thrones will know exactly what we're talking about. But also there's that Seth Rogen, Anna Faris film, Observe and Report, which has a horrific moment in it. Maybe you can sort of allude to it or talk a little bit about it. And then the Crank movies, of course, get to that idea that fight for a little bit, you know, resist for a moment. And then, of course, would you talk about that? I think it's really interesting.
Absolutely. So in Observe and Report, there is the scene where Seth Rogen's character has Anna Faris, who is like intoxicated and passed out, like completely unconscious as far as the viewer knows. He is raping her. And then he starts, you know, he stops and suddenly she wakes up out of this, you know, dead coma basically and says, did I tell you to stop? Yeah. And I should add that this movie is a comedy. And so the idea, you know, I saw an interview with Seth Rogen where he said, you know, you're watching this scene as he's raping her. You know, he didn't use that word, I would. And you're watching the scene thinking, how are they going to make this right? How could this possibly ever be right? And then she says the one thing that makes it right. And I would say, no, that did not make it right. Retroactive consent is not a thing. You know, as far as this character knew, and even stipulating it's a broad comedy, as far as this character knew, he was repeatedly penetrating a person who was unconscious. That is rape by, like, the clearest definition. And it was similar in the movie Crank, which is basically like the movie Speed, but it's a person instead of a bus. So he has to keep his heart rate above a certain level through the course of the film or he'll die. And so he grabs his girlfriend. And, you know, as I say, instead of, like, doing jumping jacks to keep his heart rate up while explaining, like, I'm in this terrible situation, can we please have sex now to keep my heart rate up? Mm-hmm. He just starts grabbing her and literally attacking her. And she's kicking at him, saying no, like, you know, desperately trying to get away from him. And then finally he overpowers her. And there's this, like, you know, tinkly music that changes everything. And suddenly she's into it. And I should also add that they are on a public street as all of this is happening. Yeah. So,
and then in
so
Crank 2, they're on a horse racing track.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even see Crank 2.
No, you don't want to.
Okay, I'm sure.
It's the same thing.
After I saw that, it was kind of – but yeah. And so that's – this stuff is really common. And it's similar with Game of Thrones there where it's that idea that – you know, there can be as much fight as you want at the beginning where as long as she looks like she's satisfied at the end, then, you know, then it's all okay that she got your consent retroactively. And that is just so gross to me because it just sends the message that you just have to keep pushing back past that resistance instead of saying, wait a minute, this person doesn't want to have sex with me. I got to slow down. I got to stop.
Yeah. And that gets us to that really kind of provocative statement that you own. You cop to the fact mm-hmm. that it's provocative. Every American sure. boy is at risk of growing up to be a rapist. Break that down a little bit. And we can use the context of what you were just talking about. Because you do mention there are things you don't mean by that, but there mm-hmm. are things you do mean by that. Would you break that down for us?
Right. I mean, you know, we all have to grow up in this rape culture together. And so boys are getting these messages, these relentless messages saying that, you know, it's super cool to, you know, oh God, I sound like so old and dated. Like, it's super cool. But it's, you know, I just realized, oh God, I sound like an old person. But that it's a high status activity to dominate women, to overpower them, and also to score sexually. And so you put those two things together and you get this really toxic environment. And then you combine that with a general sense of entitlement to women and the idea that women's bodies are objects for their consumption. You know, all of these things kind of come together to basically tell boys that girls and women are theirs to possess. And so, you know, that creates rapists. It also creates guys like Elliot Rodger, who have this toxic resentment, who was the man California a couple of years ago who shot several students and left a manifesto saying that basically it was because pretty women ignored him.
Right.
And rejected him. And so, you know, this toxic sense of entitlement tells men that they should be able to consume women's bodies without any respect for women as people. And, you know, if you grow up with all of those messages, like, good on every boy who doesn't grow up to become a rapist in this culture.
Kate Harding is with us. Her book is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Kate Harding. We're talking about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. It's a really blunt examination of sexual assault, sort of as a social phenomenon. I want to read a comment here, but before we do that, I want to refer to one of the most disturbing kind of stories that you tell, and believe me, there are plenty in the book, from that Steubenville, Ohio story where the 16-year-old girl is at a party with these other high school kids and she has a lot to drink and a couple of guys, some of them, of course, stars of this football team, they take her alone and repeatedly sexually assault her. But the thing that's so even more disturbing about the story is that in a dorm room at Ohio State, there are these people who are watching this because someone's filming it and narrating it. So let's talk about what's happening there, where this young man is narrating this video in this incredibly crass and horribly crude way. But he's expecting, you say, that all of this is going to raise his status among his peers. Would you talk about this story?
Sure. So that's something where, I mean, first of all, that's kind of, you know, the world that we live in now is where a sexual assault takes place at the party. People take videos on their phones and then they send it to each other and to, you know, to other people who weren't there instead of, you know, calling the police. And so this video was sent to a recent graduate of Steubenville High who was watching it in his dorm room at Ohio State. And so then someone's taking a video of him watching this video. And he's just cracking jokes the whole time that he's, you know, it's not even just that he's being extremely crass about describing what's happening there. It's that he's trying to make everyone laugh. And he, like, the refrain is he keeps talking about her as the dead girl, as in she's unconscious. And so he's, you know, and finally someone in the room says, dude, that's like rape. And he says, you know, he's just, well, it doesn't matter because she's dead. And it's just the most, you know, horrifying example of the dehumanization of victims and the rationalization that we come up with for these incredibly, you know, violent and horrifying acts.
You write this in your book. We need to change our culture so that young men who toss around casual pro-rape sentiments, they're the ones who are regarded as the buzzkills. Right now it's the other way around. It's like, oh, come on. Come on, Kate. You're just this shrill, puritanical person.
Right.
Anna Faris and Seth Rogen are funny. What are you talking about?
Exactly. Where it's just a joke and, you know, oh, my God, we don't mean it. We would never actually rape anybody. And, you know, what I always want to say to especially young men who are saying that kind of thing is like, no, maybe you never would rape anybody. But one of these guys in the room, maybe he would. And he thinks you all have his back.
Actively oppose sexual violence. That's one of the recommendations you make. I mean, be really
Absolutely.
Active about it and say the thing that you may be feeling. And it's interesting in seeing that interplay because you transcribe the exchange between this young man who's narrating this horrible incident. Mm-hmm. Some did kind of take him up on it and or challenge him a little bit. It was interesting to see how that played out.
Right. That gave me a little bit of hope because, I mean, it took a lot to kind of steel myself to watch that video. And at first, you do hear people laughing. The guy who's taking the video thinks the guy who's cracking jokes about this victim is hilarious. And so, you know, I was just sitting there like, oh, man, this is just one of those things that just makes you feel like the world is gone. There's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
But then these other young men do speak up finally, where they're clearly afraid to speak up. They're afraid that they're going to get blowback for it. And they do from the one guy. But one guy speaks up and then another one does. And that's what can happen when bystanders do intervene, when they see something and they're saying it's not right. And they're saying things like, man, I got a 16-year-old sister. Like, what if this was her? And that they're trying to make it about, you know, again, it's a matter of identifying with the victim instead of the perpetrators. And so that thing, if you are looking at that video and you can be cracking jokes and thinking that it's funny or it's cool, then you are definitely identifying with rapists and not with victims.
Here's an email. It comes from Alexander, who writes, at the beginning of the show, you were talking about language dilution. My question is, what's your opinion on the use of the word rape to refer to the less forceful forms, namely rape that arises from consent while intoxicated? An argument I often hear raised in debates about rape, he writes, is how even consensual sex now counts as rape. Do we need new terms to refer to the varying degrees of rape? Alexander says, I worry about the discussion becoming diluted when the same terms refer to both. It's an interesting comment here, isn't it? Because Alexander's worried about what a lot of people are worried about. You get to false accusations, which
sure.
Maybe this is a good segue into that section of the – would you respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I would say that that's a very common concern among people who don't quite understand the distinctions that are already there that we're talking about. There is no such thing as rape that arises from consent. There can be rape that happens subsequent to consent to other acts. You know, in my own case, I kissed the guy willingly. I was, you know, happy to stand there and make out with him, and then he pushed me down and raped me. And so that wasn't rape coming from consent. That was him cutting off the consensual part and beginning a rape. And so there's that, and that it's really a myth that, you know, consensual sex while intoxicated can, you know, be considered rape later. That is not true. There's this big overblown fear that women are going to get drunk, have sex, and then the next day decide, oh, that was a bad idea. So now I'm going to accuse him, or I'm going to say that, you know, I was too messed up. He should never have done that. There is a point of intoxication at which someone is no longer capable of giving consent. And if you want to have sex and you're at all confused about whether your potential partner is too intoxicated, you need to stop. You just need to say, okay, that's it. I'm not having sex tonight, or I got to go find somebody else. It's not a matter of consensual sex is later labeled as rape. It is a matter of possibly some consensual sexual activity ends and then non-consensual begins.
Are you hearing anxiety there in Alexander's email about about false accusations. And we should talk about this is one of the titles of one of your chapters, The Problem with of False Accusations.
Yeah.
And let's start with the data, because somewhere between 92 and 98% of the time, a person who reports a rape is telling the truth, which is to say the immediate assumption should be that they're telling the truth. But that's not the immediate assumption.
Right. And that's something where even police officers and detectives who have been interviewed have said some of them believe as many, you know, genuinely believe it's 50-50 that anyone who walks in and reports a rape could just be making it up for their own reasons. You know, that's as likely as that they were actually raped, which is sort of ridiculous when you know that, again, it is this incredibly underreported crime, because most people living in this culture know if they go and report a rape to the police, they're going to have their lives torn apart. They're going to have, you know, their sex life put on trial. They're going to have a whole bunch of invasive questionings, invasive, you know, if it's happening in the immediate aftermath, then invasive medical stuff. And so the idea that women would just go and it's always women that we think are making the false reports, right? That a woman would just go in and say, you know, I'm angry at this guy, and so I'm going to go accuse him of a violent crime and try and have him put in jail. Like, that's really absurd. You know, I'm not saying that has never happened, that there's no woman who is that kind of, you know, off her rocker. But it's to assume that any woman who comes to a police and says, police department and says, I was raped, might just be lying. That is just so offensive and such a bleak and horribly sexist view of women.
But you, and you also point out that investigators and prosecutors, many of them are basing their decisions to move forward on a case, which is hard enough to report, as you said. They're doing that based on a gut feeling that the victim could be lying or that the prosecution is going to be too difficult. So there, you know, there's a lot working against someone making a report.
There are cases, and I know that, you know, there was a big investigation in Salt Lake a couple of years ago there that revealed a lot of cases being marked unfounded because the police decided, well, I don't believe her. And that should not really come into it. It's not the police officer's job to make a, or the detective's job to, you know, make a gut decision on, I don't believe this person, so I'm not going to pursue it. You know, when someone reports a rape, your job is to investigate it. And that, you know, it just seems, I'm sure that there is a lot of gut work there's in detective work as there is in any job. But, you know, when you could look at this data and see how often the gut feeling can turn into presuming that, you know, a woman is lying, that in fact she is committing the crime of filing a false report. You know, your gut's not working right. You need to have checks on that gut if it keeps turning up the answer that women just lie about rape.
There's this kind of crazy irony you point out in the book that I wanted to ask you about. Women who do file false reports, and you do acknowledge that this happens, and you say it's terrible, of course, when it does.
Right.
Women who do file false reports usually create, this is interesting, a fake scenario that sounds not like the typical rape, but like our cultural idea of, a, as you put it, a rape. Explain that.
that you're actually more likely to be, you know, people presume they're more likely to be believed, and it's probably true, if they make up a rape that sounds like the very uncommon kind, which is the stranger who grabbed me, who had a weapon, who held me down, who committed visible violence to my body. That's the kind of story that someone will come in with, where you look at a Tawana Brawley or a Kathleen Crowell Webb were some famous older cases where, you know, they both actually carved words into themselves and they came in. And I think another point that's really important there, too, is that women who file false rape reports typically are looking for sympathy and attention. They are not looking to punish a specific man. And so that's another reason why they come in with a story of a stranger rape, is so that they don't have to give the police a name. So they're not trying to make anyone, you know, they're not actually trying to put someone in jail. They're just trying to get a reaction for their own edification. And so that needs to be contrasted with the fear, again, that a woman will have consensual sex with you and then just, you know, become a vengeful beast in the morning and decide to go accuse you of rape.
We should also say, as we head into a break here, you say that those chief strategies that we use to avoid trying and convicting innocent people, like denying and victim blaming, they don't really prevent false convictions. And you say we need to change the way we think about sexual violence to protect the rights of the accused and the victims. Both will get protected if we just change our thinking, you're saying.
Absolutely. The system is just kind of broken through and through when it comes to rape and arguably when it comes to everything. And we just have a system that is set up to reward prosecutors who gather the evidence that they can get to get a conviction, as opposed to prosecutors who are looking to actually, you know, find the truth. And so you have cases like the Duke LaCrosse case that people famously bring up. And if you look at what happened there, it was not just that one woman lied, although, yes, obviously that was a catalyst and it was terrible. And she's, you know, from what we know about that woman now, she was an incredibly troubled person. The prosecutor in that case, who has since been disbarred, he was so aggressive. He decided he was going to get a conviction on these guys, and he ignored all of this exculpatory evidence. And so that's a thing. It's, you know, I joke, like, it takes a village to put an innocent man in prison. It's not just a woman lies and suddenly, boom, his life is ruined.
Kate Harding is with us. Her book is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KDWR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Kate Harding. We're talking about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Let's take a call from Melinda, who's with us in Salt Lake. Melinda, hi.
Hi, Doug. Hey, I wanted to thank Ms. Harding for this, for having this discussion. It's hard to talk about, but I appreciate what she's doing because she's going to help somebody who's been in a situation where, just very briefly, my situation was that 25 years ago, I had a date rape, and I really believed it was my fault for a long, long time. I felt I had put myself in that situation. This discussion causes me to reflect and look back and think, okay, yeah, I did this situation. I put myself there. But I would never have gone to the police because I would never blame the guy. I had done it. I had put myself in that situation. I feel differently now. I feel very different. But I so appreciate Ms. Harding. Thank you for taking this topic and making it talkable. I don't know if that's the right word, but
it's a good word. Kate, do you want to respond?
Yeah. Just thanks so much for that, Melinda, and I'm so sorry that that happened to you. That is part of why I want to do this and to kind of reframe how we talk about it, to just be very clear and very black and white that there is no putting yourself in the situation to get raped. You know, people put themselves in all sorts of potentially risky situations all the time. First of all, like, going to a party should not be a situation that risks you becoming a victim of violent crime. Yeah. And second, what causes rape is rapists. It is their decision to rape. It's their decision that they want to get off on the lack of consent instead of a consensual sexual experience. And this is part of rape culture, though, where we blame the victim, where we talk so much about what victims were wearing, what they did to bring it on themselves, that's another way that we try to minimize it so we don't have to deal with the fact that sometimes it's men we like who do this. Sometimes it's your buddy. Sometimes it's a famous guy that you really admire. Sometimes it's a successful athlete. You know, or it could just be a guy that you go to school with and you never would have imagined that he's a rapist and you don't want to believe that. So then you think, well, what did she do to bring it on herself? And the answer is nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, the definition of rape is you don't want it. So we should really just be able to dispense with the idea that it is even possible to, you know, ask for rape.
So interesting, too, you write about how oftentimes, rape victims are marginalized people. And this is partly behind the failure of police departments sometimes to process the rape kits. And one of the things you write about is how victims as you were just saying, they can be imperfect.
Right.
You know, rape culture says real victims don't get confused or don't misspeak or don't make mistakes or don't date abusive jerks or have crappy families. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, these are all myths.
Right, exactly. And that you shouldn't have to be a perfect victim to not deserve to become, you know, or a perfect person to not deserve to become a victim of a violent crime. I often say there is no like bad decision threshold past which you deserve it. It's just you can make all the bad decisions you want. You still don't deserve it. And people get to make decisions, bad decisions all the time and not get raped. And I feel like it's the same as murder. And I'm not saying, you know, there's plenty of victim blaming with murder victims as well, but not quite to the same extent where, you know, that is something that at least most of us people of good conscience will say, okay, no one actually deserves to be murdered. But, you know, secretly, even if we don't think we think it, we think a lot of people deserve to be raped, and that absolutely plays out in terms of race, class, sexual orientation, gender identity. You know, the statistics are terrifying. We're up to 1 in 2 transgender people have been raped, where 1 in 3 Native American women have been raped or will be raped in a lifetime. And so It's not, so much of what we see in the news is typically, you know, it's stories like mine where it's a white girl's raped on campus.
Yeah.
And that is certainly one part of it. But we act as though that's the entirety of the kind of rape epidemic in this country. And it's absolutely not. When you look at that statistic that 1 in 5 American women will be raped in a lifetime, you can know that for certain ethnicities, it's going to be higher, that for poor women, it's going to be higher, that they're more vulnerable. And again, transgender women, et cetera. It just, the statistics are shocking enough if it's just 1 in 5, but in some communities, it's even higher and more horrifying than that.
Here's an email from Michael who writes, I was stunned at how unprepared my daughter's high school was when another student sexually assaulted my daughter. Beyond a one-page pamphlet about rape and a Xeroxed copy of community resources, the school counselor said they lacked the staff to help and the administration went silent on the matter. Yeah. Michael writes, the prevailing attitude of harassment and condescension from other students led us to transfer our daughter to another school. How is it that victims are shamed while perpetrators of sexual violence are not? You want to respond to that?
It plays out in so many scenarios, and that's absolutely one of them. And it's just, it is such a shame and so hard for victims when they can't get that support from the community. And I think with, you know, from their peers, that's part of why, you know, I want this book out here. And I've heard from a lot of people, I mean, I should acknowledge that it has a lot of salty language and explicit descriptions of things. But if you have a teenager who's ready for that, I have heard from a lot of teenagers that, you know, this is a book that speaks to them and helps them understand what's going on there. And so I'm not just trying to plug my book. I'm trying to say just, you know, there's also a wonderful website called Scarlatine that has a lot of information on that kind of thing that young people should be looking for. But as far as school administrators go, it's really the problem of people being in absolute denial that this could be happening under their nose. And it's, you know, and it's another version of the, oh, I know that guy, he could never do that. There was an article in The Atlantic a couple of months ago by Michael Kimmel, who's a guy who does a lot of research on toxic masculinity. And he was writing about the campus rape crisis and a survey that of college administrators, of presidents of colleges who said, you know, they were asked the question, do you believe that sexual assault on campus is a problem in general in the United States? And, you know, about half said yes. And then you said, do you believe it's a problem on your campus? And then it just went like way down. Almost nobody was willing to admit that it was a problem on their campus. And that's the thing. Like we need our administrators to be able to say rape is something that happens in every human community, that it's at epidemic levels in our country right now. There is no reason to assume that your school is magically immune. And when people rush to, you know, cover their asses legally, if I can say that.
You can.
Okay, good. It really is, it does a disservice to victims. It does a disservice to the entire community because it just once again reinforces these myths that that women lie and that accusations are a bigger problem than rapes and assaults themselves.
A lot we didn't get to today, the conversation about sexual assault in the military, about how law and order plays through all of this. The political dimensions are really, really fascinating. Let me ask you, though, you say there are differences between now and, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of good differences. You feel confident. But it's also interesting how you say, as you say in the book, that ever since you were raped back in 1992, you've never really banished the thought that maybe you were wrong, that you still, having written a book about this and explored all of these issues, harbor those doubts. It's really extraordinary.
Yeah, that's, I feel very comfortable saying to individuals who, were there at the time and would know who he is, that this is the man who raped me. And I said that. I brought a hearing through the school. But their finding, and I should note that the head of the committee who adjudicated this was also his advisor. He was a senior.
Right.
And
that you were raped, but you got the guy wrong is basically
exactly.
What they said.
Yeah. Exactly. And so they told me that, my friend told me that first day. And there is that constant. So I feel like, I would never name him publicly because of that tiny fraction of a chance that maybe I did get it wrong. Maybe it was somebody else. And it's kind of, I won't say it's maddening anymore. It's been over 20 years and it's something that isn't often at the forefront of my mind anymore. But it, it's very frustrating that even when people are willing to say, like, we believe you, you were raped, they still, there are still all these opportunities for incredible self-doubt.
Kate Harding, her book is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. She joined us from a studio in Minneapolis. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I should mention we have a link to Scarlatine on our website, also a link to the Rape Recovery Center of Utah. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.